Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Commercializing a new idea is not easy, and many startup companies in Edmonton get the boost they need from Brad Guthrie at the Capital Region Innovation Center. And foresight, it's more than a new buzzword. In fact, the National Research Council has an office dedicated to technology foresight. And a recent foresighting workshop attracted people from across Alberta's science and technology sectors. And white water, a new technology developed by the Alberta Research Council for the pulp industry, takes a big step towards commercialization with other applications. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Just because you have a good idea or a great invention, that doesn't mean you'll make it in the commercialization game. Connecting the dots between startup and success can be overwhelming for most people. That's where Brad Guthrie comes in. As Executive Director of the Capital Region Innovation Center, Brad provides a host of services to help cash-poor, fledgling inventors and entrepreneurs get the best start they can.
We, as I said, work with the early-stage tech companies to help them find resources. And that means we help them find business advice. So we have a mentorship program in partnership with Grant McEwen College and the Chamber of Commerce. That program matches an early-stage entrepreneur with the seasoned advice of a veteran mentor for 12 months. They get together face-to-face once per month for a couple of hours, and the mentor often takes phone calls on a weekly or bi-weekly basis. So we have the mentorship program. We do a lot of in-service training. We have a small incubator called the Innovation Business Center here, where we have seven computer-based firms being helped along by the Innovation Center. We have symposiums and networking events. The largest is Technology for Success 2003, which will be the sixth annual, will be coming up in first week of April, April 8th and 9th, and we do smaller networking functions as well. So we have an open house at the Research Transition Facility at the University of Alberta coming up, and that will be in about a month or so.
You've got your fingers into just about everything that's going on around town.
Now, we keep quite busy, and there's a lot of exciting companies coming up in both the life sciences industries and also information communication technology and electronics. And I've got quite an exciting agri-food manufacturer that wants to manufacture functional food bars and whatnot. So, yeah, it is fascinating. I really enjoy it.
Why do you think there's such a need for the work that you do?
There aren't a lot of resources for a startup company, and we're one of the few offices, I would say maybe even the only office locally in the Edmonton region that works exclusively with the startup tech-based companies. If you're a university spin-off, you have what used to be called the Industry Liaison Office and is now known as the Research Services Office to work with you because you're a faculty member creating a company, so he or she can get help there on campus. But if you don't have the link to campus, who do you turn to? Western Economic Diversification is reorganizing to have less impact on one-on-one brokering for a company, although we're funded to actually cover that gap for WD. Alberta Innovation and Science has some staff that I work closely with, but a lot of them are working with established companies, and they would not have the time to work with an inventor as much as I would. So again, inventors and that would be pre-startup and startup companies are kind of an unserved niche, so there's a role for us to have there. Another major player in established companies would be InnoCenter Alberta, which the province just got going a couple of years ago. And it actually steps in for the highest benefit potential tech companies that are coming forward and infuses them with money and mentorship to a degree that I could never hope to, but that's just for established companies. And so we've got this unserved niche that we're filling.
Is there a charge for the services that you have? Because for most people who are just starting out,
cash is the big problem. They just don't have any cash going through.
No, my stakeholder board recognizes that a raw startup might be operating off of love money or money they've used from their own savings or family or friends, and they don't have a lot of money. Many of my services are absolutely free. Some of the functions we do operate on a cost recovery basis, but they would be subsidized through sponsorships. So, for example, we have Saturday workshop, March 15th, for inventors. It will be run by the Canadian Innovation Centre out of Waterloo, Ontario, but we're bringing them here to Edmonton. That will be priced, I think, at $40 a head, which is for a full-day workshop, which would include some food and coffee breaks and a lunch. So it's a very low fee, and if an inventor is going to get anywhere, they're going to have to be able to come up with the $40. But we don't expect them to have an in-service training budget like a multinational corporation would for a professional. So, you know, they're not having to be charged $300 for a day or something like that. Very low cost. Many of our services are free, though.
Now, you mentioned the inventors. You've just launched a new inventors website. What's that all about?
Several years ago, the province, that's Alberta Innovation and Science, and other players, including my Innovation Center, had partnered on a first-generation site called the Alberta Inventors Information Index. And that was just that, an information index, so an inventor would somehow find his or her way through the path to commercialize their idea into either a saleable product or into intellectual property that could be licensed away to a manufacturer that did want to take it somewhere. And that product needed to be redone. So we've completely revamped the Inventors Information Index. And one thing we thought we needed to do was simplify the title. And so we're now calling it the Alberta Inventors Gateway. We also needed to make it easier to find on the internet. So instead of housing it on a third-party site or even on my site, it's not on my site either, but it's linked. And we've got our own Inventors Gateway .ca domain name registered so that people can find it more easily. And it just walks an inventor right from the stage that they have an idea through securing their intellectual property protection, for example, a patent, and maybe some considerations around financing and assessing market demand, right through to, how do you go about getting a license agreement, or how do you go about setting up a company to be able to manufacture this yourself.
What are some of your success stories?
Well, we've had several clients funded, multiple rounds of financing. Years ago, we worked with a company called Rome IT, and Rome had about three rounds of venture capital investment, including some local investors and I think some U.S. investors. So that client has gone somewhere. More recently, we have a client called SciMed, which is a company incubated, interestingly, by another U of A spinoff that's been operating on its own away from the university for about 10 years. PBR Labs, or Prairie Biological Research, it used to be known as, is currently incubating SciMed. SciMed is a current client, and it just achieved some traction by getting $300,000 of investment from AVAC Limited. We have another client I mentioned earlier. New Era Nutrition is doing the functional food bar technology, and they're collecting a lot of local angel investment to set up a manufacturing plant here in Edmonton. We're excited to see that.
Thank you very much, Brad.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
I was speaking with Brad Guthrie, Executive Director of the Capital Region Innovation Centre. Partners in the Innovation Centre include the National Research Council, Western Economic Diversification, Alberta Innovation and Science, the University of Alberta, and Economic Development Edmonton. I have to admit that when I first received the notice to attend a foresighting workshop, I did a double take. The event was sponsored by the National Research Council of Canada, and the man who brought it all together was Andy Gilliland of the National Institute for Nanotechnology in Edmonton. Even he was surprised by the number of leaders in Alberta's science and technology sectors who turned out to participate in the foresighting exercise.
Well, Cheryl, NRC has been interested in science and technology foresighting now for a number of years. As a matter of fact, NINT was a result of a foresighting exercise at NRC probably two or three years ago now. where we identified that the area of nanotechnology was an opportunity for Canada and that it was something that we should try to find a way to invest. And we're very pleased that Alberta saw the same vision and we were able to put NINT together. Beyond that, I think we're now realizing that to properly structure the activities of NINT, whether they be research or whether they be some sort of commercialization activity, we also need to have a good understanding of where nanotechnology is going to lead us in the next 5, 10, 20 years. And so technology foresighting in the field of nanotechnology becomes very important as we prioritize our investments, as we identify useful things that we can do to support cluster developments in Edmonton and Calgary, and as we hope to be very responsible citizens responding to the concerns of the general public when they see anything to do with new technology, and particularly very leading-edge technologies, as somehow threatening. We believe that nanotechnology is a very positive technology, and we want to find ways to be sure that we understand how to get that message out to the public. So as we look at foresighting, those are some of the drivers that we're considering.
Well, is foresighting just a fancy new name for looking ahead, or is there something special about that?
I think foresighting is a 2003 word, maybe a 2000 word. But on the other hand, I think it does neatly capture the concept of looking out a long way into the future and trying to anticipate significant changes in society, environmental, economic, technology trends, and trying to integrate all these different change experiences to identify the most likely path that we're going to find ourselves walking along. Foresighting, in some ways, is a buzzword, but I think it's a good buzzword in this case because it does indicate that we're looking ahead a long way and trying to anticipate, before we make investment decisions, all of the concerns of society as a whole, and to enable us to be very responsible in the way that we act and explain our activities to the overall public at large.
Now, it sounds like there's an actual foresighting network that's going to form out of this. What is that?
Well, we're encouraged to look at Alberta from the National Research Council and see a lot of interest. Our event today, frankly, surprised us in the numbers of people in Alberta who are interested in technology foresighting. We're very encouraged about that because I think it indicates a Western presence, which would be a very neat balance to the work that we've been doing for a number of years now at NRC based in Ottawa. We are wanting to encourage Albertans to embrace the concepts and the culture of technology foresighting, and if the attendance this morning is any indication, there is a huge interest in this field in this province, and we would like to encourage that to take place.
Thank you very much, Andy.
You're most welcome, Cheryl. It's always nice to talk to you. Thank you.
That was Andy Gilliland, the Director of Stakeholder Relations with the National Institute for Nanotechnology. One of the people Andy brought to Edmonton to kick off the foresighting event was Jack Smith. Jack runs a virtual office from Ottawa and travels the country, blazing the trail for the Office of Technology Foresight for the National Research Council of Canada.
It's really a structured attempt to look into the future, not in a predictive way, but looking at some of the plausible challenges, opportunities, and technology events and or developments that might be influencing our future and leading us into various challenges in our working world and in our R&D and various other technology-oriented pursuits with all sorts of social implications, of course, in the kinds of impacts that they might exert in the future.
Well, how does this compare to something like strategic planning? Is this something different?
Not really. It's very similar. It's got a bit more of a structured focus on some tools, such as scenario planning or on environmental scanning, which is typical of strategic planning. Technology foresight has a certain discipline of attention to the technology vectors, what's happening in science today that might develop into new technologies tomorrow, how might those technologies play out in a variety of circumstances and social and political situations, or what's Canada's role in the world of technology, global competition, etc.
What message were you trying to get across to people today?
Essentially, that foresight is an asset to any organization to be able to better anticipate the future by understanding some of the plausible alternative situations they might have to confront within whatever time frame interests them. And normally foresight, as distinguished from technology road mapping or just technology assessment, is a little bit longer term, more in the 10-year frame, beyond the range of most business planning. And so it's very suitable for research organizations and those who are highly dependent on technology change.
How did you get involved in foresighting?
I've been more or less involved in this ever since I was in graduate school and was interested in some of the work that had been done in the 1970s by the Hudson Institute and others and the RAND Corporation in the U.S., who were some of the real pioneers in foresight techniques and tools, who challenged us to imagine what life would be like at the turn of the century. Now we're past that. Some of those things, of course, did not come true as people might have thought they would. Others, faster than anticipated. People, there are things that people would not have imagined or could not have anticipated. There will always be those things, like the internet, like the personal computing, perhaps like nanotechnology and other frontier domains.
This sounds like a means of overcoming the usual resistance people have to change. Usually when we talk about people who have foresight or have vision, they're usually alone in a crowd trying to drag everybody else along.
Well, this technique really is designed to be done by teams and groups of people who challenge each other, who feed off each other's creativity, who stimulate each other's intellectual neurons, and bring insights that complement each other. The more diversity, the better. This is the nature of foresight. It creates plausible and multiple dimensions of possibility in the future, not attempting to predict which one is either desirable or inevitable, but really trying to understand a range of possible alternatives that might have to be contended with in some situation or other.
Does it involve changing your mindset?
I guess in a continual way it does. Every experience is learning. Every foresight exercise provides me with some new insights, some new facts, some new ways of framing the questions. And I'm always energized and stimulated by the groups I meet in this endeavor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Jack Smith, leader of the Office of Technology Foresight at the National Research Council of Canada in Ottawa. I also spoke with Andy Gilliland of the National Institute for Nanotechnology. Two years ago, I visited the Alberta Research Council to learn about a new technology scientists there had developed for the pulp and paper industry. As inventor Dr. Ted Garver explained at the time, it was an innovative process that used a light analyzer to detail the amount of pitch or stickiness in the pulp mill's water. Using this new technology could save the pulp mills millions of dollars. Well, Ted Garver is now the head of Aquantix, the group formed by the Alberta Research Council to commercialize the whitewater technology, or thermal colloidal analyzer as it's known. And as I learned from Ted, Aquantix is ready to take the market by storm.
Well, Cheryl, we've managed to make a major step in the commercialization. We're now working with a major instrumentation company, Varian Instruments, to provide the pitch analyzer, or we call it the thermocolloid analyzer, which makes a complicated measurement actually very simply and provides an amount of the pitch or the colloid and the stability of that pitch, which then can be used by people at a paper mill or people adjusting some chemistry to control the amount of that pitch and the stability of the pitch.
How important is this to the pulp manufacturers?
Well, a typical pulp manufacturer might spend $2 million a year on chemicals to compensate for the problems related to this sticky pitch. That is only the corner of the ice, tip of the iceberg, really, because when their machines get too fouled from this pitch, they have to stop the machines, and then production stops. And that's where really a great deal of money can be lost.
Now that you've brought in the instrument company, have you got any customers to help along with the commercialization?
That's right. We do. And in fact, the ones that are leading the pack are the chemical producers. And so we have a number of companies, Ondale, Nelco, Hercules, that are developing new chemicals and for pitch control. And they want to use our technology as a way to speed up the development of those chemicals.
Are those strictly within the pulp and paper industry?
Well, those companies have an array of chemistry within water treatment. We do have some other, there are other applications in other situations where the stability of water in oil or oil in water is really quite important. And we happen to have our applications chemist, Yaman Bullock, here to give you some further thoughts on that.
What's it been like for you trying to move this commercialization along with this new technology?
Well, Cheryl, it's always seems like it's things are going to happen a lot faster than they really do happen. And from the invention point, you particularly when you're inventing new technology, you have to go establish that technology, and then you have to put that technology into a product. And really the research involved in technology development and the research and development related to product development are really quite new. At the same time, we're also learning a lot of business practices that we haven't been familiar with before, and the whole business of contracts and making manuals and warranties and that type of thing is really expanding our mind. It's quite exciting. On the other hand, it's more work than I initially had thought.
Now that you do have some customers, how do you expect it to grow over the next little while?
Well, I think in this year we are working on selling the unit to high-profile customers that really can generate a lot of value from it. Our team is small enough that we can't get all our message out to all the small players. I'm thinking within the next year or so, we're shooting to sell only in the 5 to 10 region of these analyzers. I think that, though, it should be a multiplicative effect, and so we should have good growth, maybe a couple 100% growth in this instrument for the next 3 or 4 years.
How much do they cost?
We have two models, and depending on what you want to do with it, the cost is around $35,000 for the lower end model, and about $70,000 for the better model.
So when you consider how much it improves someone's efficiency in the process, that's actually just peanuts, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, we shouldn't have too much trouble.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Cheryl.
Hello, Cheryl. My name is Yaman Bullock, and I am a development and application chemist with Aquantix.
Now, that's one of the things that Ted Garver had talked about, is that even though this technology was originally developed to help solve problems in pulp and paper mills, it's found that it can be applied in other areas. What would be some of those areas?
That's right. The other areas are just like in the pulp and paper pitch application, just water in oil or oil in water emulsion types applications, which involves cosmetic industry, for example. If I give an example, in cosmetic industry, there are thousands of chemicals screened for product formulations and developing new formulations. And the thermal colloidal analyzer shortens the way to bring new products or formulate stable products in a shorter time frame.
How would it do that?
It would do, basically, we evaluate the stability of the emulsions, and one of the key factors in the cosmetic industry is to evaluate the shelf life or the thermal stability of emulsions.
What does that mean?
It means that either intentional creams or other beauty or cosmetic products, you want a certain stability or some instability. And to control that, the best way is measurement, and a speedier measurement is the thermal colloidal analyzer.
What is it that you're actually measuring?
What we are measuring is how the particle size change in the application of thermal, I would say, a thermal shock or thermal history. And that way you can predict or evaluate the stability in the time frame as well.
What makes that different from the methods that the manufacturers are using now?
Well, the current method is basically either observe the stability during the longer time or do some other indirect measurements.
So this makes it more precise?
Exactly. It makes more precise and also more quick to scan the ingredients.
Now, You've spoken about this in terms of the cosmetics industry, but are there other applications?
Certainly. The other application, I can give an example, is jet fuel applications. And in jet fuel, water is always a problem. This is the water you cannot see. It's just a molecularly bound water. Nevertheless, they are a problem in the low temperature environment. And thermal colloidal analyzer is a good way to measure the by light scattering how the water particles and their presence and stability with temperature change in the low temperature environment.
And any other applications?
Yes, another application is, for example, food industry. Again, food industry involves formulation of numerous products such as salad dressings and others, which contains, again, oils, and especially these days, minimize the fat content, and stability is an issue. And this is another potential application.
Well, you may be a scientist, but I think you're a good salesman, too. Thank you very much.
I thank you, Cheryl. It's a pleasure talking to you.
That was Dr. Yaman Bolak, Applications Development Specialist for Aquantics at the Alberta Research Council. I also spoke with Dr. Ted Garver, inventor and now manager of Aquantics, the group formed to commercialize the new thermal colloidal analyzer technology for the Alberta Research Council. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website. The web address is innovationalberta.com. And keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Capital Region Innovation Centre, Alberta Research Council, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, True North Energy, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.